Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello, welcome to Going Off Track.
Hello, and welcome to you.
Welcome to me.
Who's this cute guy over here?
This is Steven. The Steven you're used to.
With a PH.
With a PH.
Steven has been in the room for like the last 8 podcasts, probably.
Probably, since we started doing them over here at Pulse Music.
Pulse Music, that's 29th Street in Manhattan.
Exactly.
All your recording needs.
All your recording needs. Voiceover, band work, whatever you need.
Whatever you need.
Podcasting. I'm looking at a whole array of beautiful guitars over here.
Yeah.
We're in the control
really
room right
nice
now.
Guitars. Great live room, great board.
This I would is recommend it.
Classic API 1608.
Nice.
It is, yeah. In fact.
This guy Jonah really knows his stuff.
It's funny because this is the board we had at Rubber Track, so we haven't
really
gone. Yeah, we've stayed close to home with that. And in fact, well, no, those are different diffusers, but similar.
Very interesting. Today on the podcast, speaking of boards and recording, we have a producer.
Hell yeah, baby.
John Aniello. John has produced albums. I'm looking at his discography, but there's too many. Dinosaur Jr., Hold Steady, Thurston Moore, Sunvolt, Andrew WK, Sonic Youth. Insane resume. So many records.
Very insane.
Holy Sons.
Holy Sons. Yes, he did the Emil's new record with Holy Sons, and he also did the last Motion City soundtrack record, which is kind of how we sort of met. And Steven also is a fan of John's podcast.
Very big fan.
Oh,
what's it
really
called again?
This is actually the first podcast I think I make a noise in. I ask a question.
Yes.
For the first
yeah
time.
Keep an ear out for Steven
oh,
to
good
pipe
thing
up
you're in
during
the
podcast.
It's groundbreaking.
It is. But what's the name of John's podcast?
It's called Gear Club.
Gear Club. Yeah,
it's really awesome. It's yeah with him and Stuart. I can't remember his last name. I can't believe I'm blanking right now.
It's okay. That's what we do here.
Yeah.
Going Off Track.
We'll edit it in.
It's awesome. If you dig like old school stories about just like
yes
studios in New York, right, and they have really interesting guests, great podcast.
I'm going to add it to my list because I've been falling out with some of my tech podcasts lately. So
they get nerdy with the gear stuff, but they also,
it's okay.
It's for everyone.
Yeah.
You could be a layman.
Do you think
none of us are, but
no. Yeah. I know a thing or two about musical equipment.
Absolutely.
What do you know? How many strings on a guitar? Quick. Come on.
6, unless you're in Korn. Anyways, John is here. John's great. John was really sick when he did this episode, but he didn't cancel at the last minute. He showed up.
Why, has that happened recently, John?
So props to John for following through on a commitment. And let's get into it with John Aniello.
It's going off track!
All right, thank you so much for coming, John.
Oh, no worries. These... So where's our buddy Emil?
Emil's on his way.
Fucker.
He's
he's out floating down a river
yeah
on,
he's on
some
his
sort
way
of psychotropic.
Sorry, but I need to blow your...
No, it's fine.
Blow your roll.
Emil will show up at some point.
He's floating.
In the next 10 minutes, probably.
Emil, awesome. Emil who had at one of our live podcasts, the utmost balls to play the full song Suicide is Painless.
Yeah,
in such a way that only I think Brad and I were like, that's from the movie.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
It's amazing.
I was sort of, I mean, I know you've been around for a while, but I was introduced to you through Justin Pierre.
Yeah, yeah,
because
yeah.
he was staying at my house when you produced that Motion City record.
We were mixing it, I guess.
You were mixing it, yeah. And he was so excited to be working with you.
Oh, we had so much fun. Yeah. I love him.
Yeah, he's great.
He's
yeah.
one of my favorite people.
Yeah. yeah, we had a blast. And yeah, that was a really fun record to make. I mean, you know, that I knew them forever, and just going to Minneapolis, going to Pachyderm with them, and you know, making them track all live, you know, when it was such a different thing for them, you know,
right.
they were so used to like Rick Ocasek having them do drums and bass and stuff like that, and just say, no, you guys go out there and you've played 1,000 shows in your lives, go play together, and they were like, what? And it was great. It was like fun, but me and Justin totally bonded. You know, whenever I've gone back there, I've visited them. My daughter, my older daughter, who's 28 now, became huge friends with them and has hung with them. Like it was okay. There's a total connection between my family and the Pierres.
And those guys sound like they're so influenced by Dinosaur Jr. and all these sort of bands that you had sort of came up with.
The thing that they hit me with was the Jawbox record I did in 96.
Mm. Okay.
They love that record, and that was a live record. So, yeah, buddy.
Hey, buddy. We just started. We're good.
Yeah.
We're good.
Yes. I hope so. No, you're right here.
Welcome, Emil. Yeah.
You're right here.
Emil's here.
Right in my lap.
This is exciting.
Good to see you.
Look at you.
You don't look sick.
No, I've been in bed for like 3 days.
Okay.
Yeah. All right, continue. Go ahead. I'm not stopping anything.
Emil drifts in. See, Jonah? I did one of yours.
Talk about vibe killer.
I know, right? John was just talking about how he produced a Jawbox record. No big deal.
And no one cares about it.
96? I was going to say, yeah.
Yeah.
But it was the self-titled. And when I met with them the first time or talked to them, we did rehearsals like previous to the record. And they kept referring to that record that I guess maybe they were growing up and that record spoke to them. And that was the kind of thing where it was like, well, you know, those guys Jawbox went on tour for a month before we started the record and played the whole new record. So when we got in the studio, they knew the record down pat. It was like so great. They already had figured out what worked and what didn't work, you know, just, you know, by crowd response, and they had tweaked the songs, and we basically rolled into Water Music, and they were just on point. It was really fun. And
Zach's a very thoughtful drummer, right?
He's amazing.
He knows exactly what he's going to play.
He is, and I love him, and we're obviously still friends to this day, but I just always remember watching him as he was like the guy in the desk. He was just like, you know, like matter-of-factly just playing all this amazing, arrhythmic stuff, but also rhythmic, and just like as if it was just, he was just like signing things and like stapling something. And it was just so amazing to watch him do that. And
was Jay producing at that time? Was he recording?
No, I produced it. So basically that was like,
did you teach him everything?
Teach him, but we still, you know, we actually have gone over the years back and forth with stuff. He called me 2 weeks ago. We were talking about some things. We've maintained a really good friendship over the years. And I won't say it's like a mentoring thing, but it's a thing where, I mean, once again, it's like this thing where you make a record with someone and you just love them as people, which I have with this guy right now. And it's like, you always have this friendship, this bond. And over the years, like I've, you know, gone down to Baltimore to help Jay with stuff or whatever, but he can pick up the phone and ask me a question. And we're also just friends. We laugh about stuff. When I turned 50, my wife threw me a surprise party, and him and he came up from Baltimore. Zach was there, and it was really, it's just wonderful. But yeah, no, I was the actual producer of the record, but I could tell Jay was super savvy. You know, he was always like watching, and just I knew he was thinking about what, he was very thoughtful about what was going on.
What was it like working on the Holy Sons record?
Torturous.
Talk as if he's not here.
Yeah.
No, okay. No, we had so much fun. It was just me and him.
Yeah.
Right? We just had so much fun.
Not real normal. I mean, compared to like the Jawbox thing, which is old school, like, you know, they're like finely tuned as a machine.
Right.
So this was more like two people effortlessly hanging out and just kind of not even thinking. I don't think we ever even really even talked about what we were doing.
Well, we had those lunches. We had a bunch of lunches before.
But I mean, we probably talked about like taking acid and stuff.
Well, of course.
We weren't like, okay, so this is like super important that we capture, you know, this, you know, British prog vibe from the summer of 73 when they were on, you know, their third tour. They weren't as good, but it sounded cooler, you know.
But we talked about arrangements and stuff, and we went back and forth. I mean, we had a plan. Like, I remember before we went in, we tweaked a bunch of the songs. pretty good, like vibe wise, and even just like some of the songs, like cut out a couple of things, and you know what I mean?
Yeah, you're right. You're right. But in terms of like, I think the beauty of it for me, and this goes into sort of what you were just talking about, it's like finding these very close friendships as you're in the business of it all. You know, you're running around, you wake up and you're just at work.
Right.
You don't know if you like the people you're working with, but over the years, there's a few people, some maybe more aesthetically, but some aesthetically and familial wise drift into your life, and you only have this stable, you know, if you were on your deathbed or something, you would think of these people, and there's something about, I don't know why it happens, like what it is that you sense in that person. It's not really obvious, it's not really specific, but it's just, it's this familial thing. It's like we're in the shit together,
right?
But it's like there's a weird trust, and that was very relieving compared to like a band going in and trying to, you know, make a hit record or something. There wasn't any sort of pressure like that. It was more just like two people enjoying what they do without thinking about it too much.
You remember the first time you came to see me at Fluxivity?
Yes.
We were going to have lunch. And he rings the bell, and I open the door, and he's got a coffee cup with no top on it. And for the first minute, I was like, what the fuck are you holding? He's like, coffee cup. How come you got no top on it? He's like, I don't know. I was like, that's insane. Like, we talked for about a minute.
But
I was like totally like outraged, like walking around with a...
This is preposterous.
Like, yeah. Without a... I was like, what happens if a fucking pigeon shits in your coffee? What happens if you trip and you spill all your coffee? And that went on for way longer than it needed to be. But I thought that was...
Yeah, like
it was great that was the first conversation we had.
A couple hours in or something, you know, he's like, so you're from Florida and, you know, what you grew up doing what? And, you know, he's like, Why don't you have a fucking lid on your car?
Yeah. Like, John, I have a similar instinct right now. I'm like, I want an answer. This because it's so abnormal.
Oh, it's totally disturbing
hot
to me as a New Yorker.
A lid, like,
as
why?
Someone who grew up in New York.
I'm like, why?
I think
it's like, how dare you?
I mean, where from
who
here?
Do you think you are?
Lid, you go napkin over the
yeah.
lid
yeah.
So you don't even have splash.
Yeah.
I mean, this is, like, I can't even imagine.
I grew up like, I feel like I sound like a simpleton, but like I never locked my door or anything. So like there was always this sense of like
just carefree.
Just yeah, this trusting kind of like my guru when I was a kid came down from Boston and he would make fun of me because I was a typical Chapel Hill kid in that he was like, you guys are just fucking flighty down here. Like you just don't care about anything. You know, the sun shines every day. Everybody fucking loves you, supports you. He, like, you know, city kids don't understand that.
That's they're a
like,
tough guru.
Yeah. Well, there's a defensiveness. There's a tough exterior. Like, I was walking past a, you know, some mural maybe of Biggie Smalls or something. It kind of came to me, like, that, you know, a lot of dudes like that personified, you know, Brooklyn are like they have a tough exterior, and then right when you get past that they just turn into like the softest teddy bear is my assumption, but it's like a defensive layer, and I didn't have to ever have one, so I was just kind of fucking happy-go-lucky and around with no lid, you know.
Have you built one?
But I'm also a father. So I spend my entire day going, why the fuck you do? How do you wear yeah. your shoes? Why are you not wearing socks? What the fuck? We got to get on the bus.
What is that, man? Because I've got two, and they just turned six, and it's like all of a sudden reason has formed in their head. It's like the one thing Catholics got right, the age of reason, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it's, I do that constantly, and I read that there's around 4 and around 14 is when the frontal lobe hits communication again.
Right.
And so legitimately when a teenager looks at their parent and goes, you don't understand me, the parent goes, no, I don't. There's like no functional way for you to do that. Does that end? You have older children.
Well, I've got a 28 and an 11. And I got to say the best part about that was I got to forget all the problems when the 28-year-old got older, and then we became buddies and she became my wingman and we went to shows together, and you know, we'd be playing dice on a tour bus at 4 a.m. I'd be like, shit, we got to get out of here. We got to go home. I forgot all the stuff growing her, having her grow up, and it hurts even more now because I have to remember, like every morning when I wake up my 11-year-old and go, all right, we got to get on the bus, and she's like, I don't want to get up. It's like, ugh, you know what I mean? So it's like, it's even more crushing in a way. But no, they have a they just have a thing, you know. It's really funny. No matter where you're at as a parent, they're just so focused on what they know, and they know better. You know what I mean? And they exist to tell you no. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? They just exist to, you know, well, you guys all grew up in bands and shit, right? I rebelled. When I was a kid, my parents were immigrant Italians, and I was like doing acid in my basement listening to Pink Floyd. So, I mean, that's pretty much rebelling.
I thought that was compulsory at that time.
Part of the uniform.
Huh? Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Bensonhurst, Brooklyn, which, if you look back, it was the land of Saturday Night Fever.
Sure.
Like real cuisine-y Italian.
What's like your favorite like deep cut Italian dish? I'm not talking like a veal francese, like something that you can't find on like your standard Italian menu.
Well, we still go back. There's a really great like kind of mobby restaurant in Bensonhurst that we always take my mom for her birthday. She turned 79 this year, called L&B's. And the other name for it is Spumoni Gardens.
Oh, okay.
And I will tell you, we just do family style. And this year we had 20 people. And the Spumoni is amazing. It's Italian ice with like pistachio chocolate and like almond or something like that. It's pretty amazing. But their linguine and clam sauce is fucking amazing. And their seafood salad like appetizer is just ridiculous.
The seafood's spot there.
But no, it's also, you get your manicotti and all that crap. I mean, it's across the board, it's great.
Did you grow up in a house saying macaroni and gravy?
My parents were Italian immigrants, but they grew up with the American dream. So they raised three hippie kids. Like, both my older brothers were hippies, long hair. And my older brother was like a huge Grateful Dead fan. And all the music I got turned on to was through my brothers. So... But we were surrounded by this neighborhood of, you know, once again, mobbed up, safest neighborhood in the city.
Didn't
because
need cops,
no grandmother ever got mugged or, you know what I mean? Like, no shit went down ever. I mean, if anybody got whacked, there was a reason.
Until Son of Sam.
But they nailed him. He was the last guy because he got that parking ticket or whatever he got.
His final murder was near John's house. Yeah.
Really?
It was in my neighborhood. Yeah.
Holy shit.
And last one was in Benson. I have
a friend in Jersey City. You know Ethan from... So Ethan, I took him on a little tour of Bensonhurst years ago, and I took him to the Son of Sam place, the last place, the Dog Day Afternoon place where they filmed French Connection, the car chase
under
the L.
Yeah, the
and I took him to the Welcome Back Cotter High School.
Yeah.
So there was all this shit going on in my neighborhood that was just crazy. And, you know, 1977, I'm long hair and we're in the park getting high until basically a bunch of cousines come in and go like, hey, faggots. And then we just all scatter. And was pretty much a lot of the summer. You know? It was very fast.
That was your summer of
Sam. Yeah.
People forget the old school Italians of New York City who like scared the shit out of anyone who wasn't them.
Yeah.
I grew up with stories of my father being a Jewish kid in North Bronx, and then the Jewish immigrants were like the poor trash and the Italians were like the tough middle class kids. And he's like the only way I got by is like I did their math homework for them.
Right.
There's this group of guys called the Vendettas, and they were these like Italian gangs and stuff. I'm like, I'd love to just be a fly in the wall and see some of that. It's like a movie.
Yeah, you're okay. You know, at the end of the day, I made it, but it was dicey.
Could have went the other way.
But like, think of Vinnie Barbarino from Welcome Back, Kotter, but really mean and like, like scary.
Because that's
what it was like. These guys were really, it was pretty crazy. And that
were they into like, you say you were like, doing drugs and stuff at that time. Were those guys into like doing drugs?
I don't think so. Because I think if they smoked a lot more weed, they'd be a lot more chill. You know what I mean? They eat more pizza and beat up less hippies.
But that actually, that leads to my next question. So when you were, you know, smoking weed in the park and your brother was doing his thing, so somehow your brother turned into your eventide job? Can you talk about that?
Yeah. So basically, when I was a kid, when I was 17, my brother's 10 years older. So he went to CCNY, got an engineering degree.
Also where my father went.
Perfect. Funny. Drove a cab for a while. taught math I don't know what level of school, but was a teacher for a while. And then got this job at this fledgling company called Eventide, which was on 54th Street and I want to say 8th Avenue. right across from where the Ritz was.
Oh, okay.
Studio 54 was at that time. And yeah, they were cutting edge digital technology. And so basically, because I was just kind of motivated like the rest of my brothers and my parents raised us, my summer job when I was like, I guess 17 was, you know, every day I'd show up at Eventide and put together flangers, delay lines, and do all that shit. And would literally just be production, which as a 17-year-old, I made enough money to have my, like, I was the first of my friends to have a bank account, a banking card. I bought my bitchin' stereo when I was a kid, my Pioneer SX737 receiver. Like, nice. You know, it was like, yeah.
I've got my dad's receiver from 76. Yeah,
made my Pioneer. Neighbors really mad in my basement because I would just crank tunes.
Because there's just such good pieces of machinery.
And so anyway, that was the beginning. And I did that for a bunch. And I knew it was time to quit college when I was basically in Brooklyn College and then take the train after and go to Eventide at like 5 o'clock and work until 8 o'clock. I was like literally just working all the time. And I was like, yeah, I don't really care. You know, at that point I went from 3.6 grade point average to like 2.4. And I was like, I need to do something. And then my middle brother got me an interview at the record plant when I was 19.
Oh, wow.
As just a general, you know, just a guy cleaning rooms and filing tapes at working in the tape library. So that's really how the whole thing started.
What was your middle brother's sort of legacy? What was he doing?
So he was working at the record plant. He was he was a maintenance guy. He was basically aligning tape machines and fixing stuff. And you know, the record plant at that point was a 4-room massive complex. So they had a full maintenance staff of like 4 guys. And back in the old tape days, you know, you had to go around to each room and align each tape machine. Yeah. I mean, it was like, you know, pretty much a routine. I mean, it wasn't like now where you turn on Pro Tools and you're ready to go. You know, if there were problems with the tape machine, you had to fix shit. I mean, it was real work for these guys.
Did the tape machines need to get up, set up
every day?
Every session?
Every day.
Wow.
Yeah, every day. You would just put up the tones and align, record a line, play back a line, and then even do the multi-tracks. That's 24 tracks, and then do the quarter inch, the 2-track.
Right.
Back then it was quarter inch. Now we mix the half inch.
Yeah, right.
But no, it was a real gig. I mean, it was real responsibility.
Huh.
Even back then for me as a tape librarian, you know, think about the days of tape. I mean, we had all the Born to Run tapes, and, you know, we had a huge tape vault in the roof. And the whole point was when Columbia needed that tape, you didn't just give someone the tape. There was a whole thing about signing out and stuff because you had to be accountable for the tape, because if any tapes went missing, you'd lose your job. It was a real problem for the studio. So it was really serious shit then.
Yeah.
It wasn't like a hard drive. Oh, you know, we finished the Holy Sons record. I gave Emil a hard drive. I have a hard drive. We're good to go.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, this was a real serious, serious business.
Sure.
Old Johnny here, I believe.
That sounds horrible.
Old Johnny.
But even better, see my cough. Like, ah.
Just picture Johnny
Carson. Is that his Christian name, Old Johnny?
Yeah. That's my porn name.
It'll make...
Actually, that's my penis's porn name. I'm Johnny. I'd like you to meet Old Johnny.
This is Old Johnny.
Wrinkly, but it works.
Exactly.
I was going to say, which would have been
logical.
His middle
name is Flaccid, but whatever. We don't talk about that much. Old Flaccid Johnny.
How's Old Johnny feeling right now?
He's a little flaccid.
All right. You're sick. It's fine.
Yeah.
I believe he was in the record plant when John Lennon got killed, because John Lennon came in to the record plant and left, and I think John was there.
I wasn't working on the session, but I was one of the like general guys helping the setup.
Wow.
Yeah, we were actually at that point. I was home watching Monday Night Football. But they were in there. It was post Double Fantasy. They were doing.
So you heard it from.
I heard it from Howard Cosell.
From Howard Cosell.
Which was fucked.
That's the way, yeah.
Because the next day we went into work and it was a shit show there. There were film crews.
Stopped the middle of the football game and like.
Yeah. Yeah, it was fucked. It was crazy. But what happened was they'd finished Double Fantasy. They actually recorded Double Fantasy at Hit Factory, which was kind of a little bone of contention because obviously Hit Factory and Record Plant were rivals.
Mm-hmm.
Lennon had done like Walls and Bridges at Record Plant and Rock and Roll. He's done a bunch of records there. But anyway, I think what they did was they wanted to do like songs after the fact, after the record. So they went back to the record plant as kind of like a peace offering. And they were there when the shit went down. Yeah, it was pretty fucking crazy.
And you must have been connected in a community where a lot of people knew him. And
yeah.
Yeah.
My buddy Steve, who is my kind of the guy who was above me, who grew me up into an assistant, not necessarily an engineer, but he brought me through the ropes to get from the library to assistant engineer. He was actually assisting on that session.
Wow. Yikes.
And we're still friends now. He's a big shot, like, engineer guy in Nashville. We're still, like, totally tight buds. But he was working on that session. It was fucking crazy. But the next day, like I said, walking around the halls, there were film crews everywhere. Like, you couldn't walk down the hall without people, like, just videoing the big guitar he had given the studio and interviewing people. It was pretty fucking, it was way more real than I would ever want to deal with. You know what I mean? It was really fucked up.
What was the record that you think, like, as they say in wrestling, put you over? Like, the one?
Me?
Yeah. Where you felt like,
I know what I'm doing?
Oh, well, that's...
I have yet to make that record.
That's two questions.
But that's why I'm still really into I do.
All right.
Now, there are different, like, parts of my, you know, so-called career. Mm-hmm. But, like, as an assistant, a record that I worked on, which I basically got into a really good crew, was assisting on the first Cyndi Lauper record. I ended up working with an engineer named William Whitman, who once again still buddies with. I think a common thread in what I say is I'm still buddies with all these people, you know, there's, like, lifelong things. But he became my mentor, and I basically learned everything he does as an engineer, and I still incorporate a lot of the shit he did as mine, like snare sound, guitar sound, and just the way he monitors and just his thing. So that was an important record for me because I became part of this team that made a lot of records after that. Mm-hmm. I learned a lot from him, and the producer was this guy, Rick Chertoff, who, by the way, today's his birthday on Facebook, I saw, and he's a great producer, real song-oriented guy. I mean, that first Cyndi Lauper record, he picked, like, if you look at the songs, they're all, a lot of them, not all of them, are covers, but the covers that he picked are really wonderful. But then moving forward in the 90s, I was lucky enough in the course of a year to make a record with the Screaming Trees and a record with Dinosaur Jr., and both those records in, like, early 90s did really great. And I think that kind of got me into a world where people trusted me to make kind of alternative, you know, rock records.
My wife worked for the booking agent that handled Mark and Jay Maskus for years.
There you go.
And so she,
what a team.
Steve Call, I think.
Steve Call. I know him forever. Yeah.
My wife worked there for years.
Amazing.
In fact, when
he's a great guy.
Awesome. And I think when Beyond came out, Joan and I were working. And I think Jonah, we worked on a TV show together, and he wrote the interview for, I think it was you, right? Dinosaur Jr.?
Yeah.
You were there, yeah. And we showed up, and it was like the first time Lou and Murph and come back together. And Henry Rollins had come on one of the shows and was talking all about that record.
Yeah, they did the interview, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
It was so good.
Yeah, yeah. John, I was curious. I mean, Jay Maskus, obviously, like, amazing guitar, one of my favorite guitar players. I mean, what's it like recording him? I mean, is he just, like, ripping solo after solo? Like, how much direction do you give someone like that who kind of has so much of their own style?
So, just to put things in perspective, back in with Where You've Been, Without a Sound, I did the records from top to bottom.
Okay.
In the new Dinosaur Jr. reboot, which is wonderful, by the way, because they've made four great records, and I don't know how many reunions you could say are as, you know, vital now as they were back then, I'm basically coming as the mixing engineer.
Okay.
So I won't say I'm sitting around while he's ripping solos, but I do know there's a lot of times I'm mixing and he's, like, in a spare bedroom with a little rig and just shredding. But I know from back with those records, and also I did a bunch of stuff with when he did The Fog, and I work on the solo records. But my favorite thing about Jay with the solos back then was he would just solo from the beginning of the song to the end of the song. He would just hit record on the analog tape machine, and he would just shred the whole way. And then at the end of the song, you'd hit rewind, you'd arm another track, and he'd do the same thing. And then you'd have four tracks, and you would just go to the solo and just comp those solos. But he just fucking went for the whole.
That's, like, exactly what I wanted.
Yeah. Me too. No, can we hear those just full solo songs?
Yeah, all four of them.
You know,
yeah.
They exist somewhere.
Yeah.
And I wasn't really smart enough to actually do roughs of that shit for my own little private library because I was never... I always, you know, being in that world of trust, you never want to do anything where someone is like, what the fuck? Yeah. You know what I mean? But I never had it in my brain to be like, I should just double this shit and make a fucking loop of Jay solos, and here I go. And there was no internet, so I wouldn't do anything with it anyway. So
yeah.
Is it ever difficult? Like, do you have to change your headspace when you're going into a record top to bottom? and then you're going in as a mixing engineer, do you have to like wear a different hat, or you kind of come in with the same attack?
I think at this point, after doing it for so long, I'm kind of just good. You know what I mean? I don't really, I look at what I do. I'm here to make emo the best record I can make him at. You know what I mean? At this point, you know what I mean? It's like I'm hired to work and just make sure his record is as good as it could be at that point.
Right.
And it's the same thing with the mixing. I feel like I'm just hired to make them the best sounding record I could make them. You know what I mean? So for me, it's not like I kind of trouble over what my place is.
Right.
And I will try things messing around, but I always defer to the artist. And if there's any ever confusion, I will pitch my idea if I really think it's great, to the point of I really will pitch it, but never to the point of being like a douche. You know what I mean? Nobody needs to be a douche in this studio. Yeah, at the end of the day, it's their record. I do want it to be great. And one of the things I say is, you know, if we're A-B-ing two things and my idea loses, when the record comes out, no one else is ever going to know we A-B these two fucking things.
It's true.
You know what I mean? So it's not like I told you so. You know what I mean? Yeah. It doesn't fucking matter.
Do you feel like success has changed emo?
I feel like he's a little too fun these days.
Yeah.
Just for a visual to everyone listening, Emil's sitting red-faced in between Jonah and John right now.
Wearing nothing but cashmere.
That's because I have my hand on his lap.
How's old Johnny doing over there?
Yeah, old Johnny's still flashing.
I see animal heads. I see fruit. I see leather. It's bizarre over there. I don't know what's happening.
I think one thing that bonds us, maybe inadvertently, but is that we're both like, he's a real live workaholic. He's like a real motherfucker. So he's not going to go home until he hits the complete wall, you know? And I'm the same way. I mean, our jobs are different, but it's like soothing to meet another hardcore workaholic, because you both know you're going to try as hard as you can until it's just not possible anymore. And that's what kind of allows you to lay your head down at night and go to bed, because you just literally try as hard as you can. And if you can tell yourself that, like I did the best I could in this circumstance, then you can just leave it and close the door and say I did it, you know. That's definitely a big thing. I'm sure you can relate for like live performance. It's like you're in a constant blizzard of compromise. You're just like, nothing is ever right. Even if it seems like in soundcheck it's going to be absolutely perfect, you almost get more worried because you know something's going to be completely
opposite.
Something
strange is afoot.
Yeah, right. Yeah. It's somehow going to be completely thrown off by the presence of the crowd or something. And so, anyway, like he's saying, it's like they hire him, we hire him to make the record as good as he can make it. And he knows, he's aware of his abilities. He's been doing it for so long. He tries as hard as he can with what he's been handed, if he's mixing something. And then if you can tell yourself, I literally did the best I could, that's why you can kind of walk away and just say, you know, you got what you got and you paid for what you paid for. But you have to feel like you tax yourself all the way to the furthest extent, you know?
But I also feel like it's like I use the word hire, but I don't want it to be as cold as just like, you know, a contract, like someone, you know, contracted to like do a kitchen in your house. I mean, I feel like what we do is super creative and super fun. And I think the fun thing, I always say, if I wanted to be really have a serious job, I would have been a dentist. The hours would have been better, weekends off and shit like that. I do this and work weekends and have been divorced twice, you know, because I love making records. I love music and I love just having fun at work. And that's part of the reason why I feel like I can do 12 hours or more if I have to, because I just enjoy it. It's like there's nothing else I'd rather be doing. But that's why we have all kinds of fun with mixing. We set up, you know, all kinds of weird effects, and we do things that are wacky when we're tracking. We'll put like a guitar as a room mic through an amp, through a pickup, or, you know what I mean? We'll set up all kinds of weird mics. I'll do an acoustic guitar, but it'll go through an amp and a phaser pedal. You know, it's like all this, we just do all this weird shit because, you know what, we can. Yeah. And let's just create like a cool vibe. And at the end of the day, if I record an acoustic and there's 10 tracks of all kinds of weird shit, if we don't like it, we can just hit the mute button. It's like, ah, fuck it. You know, who cares? You know, it's like fine. But I'd rather it just be expansive and fun and just try things and not necessarily just be like, okay, here we are, push up the bass drum. You know, it's not like that. It's more like, yay! Yeah.
Do you ever feel that something's finished, or do you feel that it's like, as Picasso said, abandoned?
I know, I'm good at the finishing. I feel like I've been in too many situations where we've finished and then we've ruined it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Where I know when it's finished. And I'm also pretty good at knowing that, okay, we're at 98%. The next 2%, even if we get it, no one else will know it's there. Or we could just turn this horribly. You know what I mean? Like, I had an artist last year where we did mixes, and my mixes sounded really good, and then we tweaked them further and further and further, and then at the end of the day, we went back to my mixes because the other mixes weren't that good. But I knew they were good, but I didn't want to say to the artist no. I'm also, one of the things, I have a hard time telling the artist no. So a lot of times I will try to hedge my bets and figure out how to get the best of both worlds. Mm. You know, get my mixes in one place, and then even if we, like, fuck the mix up or whatever, we can still go back to my mixes. But it's an arc, you know? It's like painting a picture, you know, a picture or making a movie. I mean, Ishtar took how long to make, and it was a terrible movie. Oh, yeah. You know what I mean? Like, there is the possibility of taking art so far that you've lost the plot.
Well, both of those people, Dustin Hoffman and Warren Beatty, each had approval on their lines and script. So they just kept fucking with each other on over there. So there was no partnership. It was each person trying to get that. So when
are we talking about Ishtar?
We're talking about Ishtar. And I have to say, after a million downloads, finally we're talking about Ishtar.
I've never heard of Ishtar.
Oh my god,
I've heard of it. It's like the big dig.
No,
like
movies, it's so good.
Right? It's literally the worst movie ever made. Like Plan 9 from Outer Space is way better.
Really?
I've seen Return to the too.
Yeah.
Return to the Valley of the Dolls is better than fucking Ishtar.
Yeah. Well, Ishtar is actually, but it's also great. Now, if you watch it, it's actually funnier now because it's so bad, it's funny. But it was a total debacle at that point.
But it's got to be.
It was like Heaven's Gate, which was another.
But when you work with an artist who, I mean, obviously you've been doing this for a while, you know what you're doing. And then you're working with an artist who might not have been doing this for a while, but know how they want to sound. That's got to be very tricky to be able to.
Yeah, I mean,
strength of persuasion. I don't mean being like, I know this, you don't, but like, they know their song, legit, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
But you know how things work.
I've been pretty lucky because I've had a couple where I've had to pull out the, how many records have you made? Two. I've made 250. Maybe I know what I'm talking about. You know what I mean? Like, I've had to pull that out once or twice in my life. But I don't like being, once again, I don't like being that guy because that's kind of like a dick move, you know?
When I get my pants on, I make gold records.
Yeah. See, I can't really say that because I don't have a ton of them. But I should call a friend who has like a bunch of Grammys and have him talk to the artist. And say, I have 5 Grammys, listen to John. But the thing is, like, at a certain point, you got to really fight. Like, I did a record years ago where I had to do, I joked his and her mixes. Same thing, where I did, like, my mixes, which were great, and then I had the guy, like, you know, do his mixes, which were terrible. And I kept saying to the guy, if I play the record company your mixes, I'm going to get fired. I know I'm going to get fired because they're terrible. So we had this whole thing, and we finally met in the middle. But, yeah, that happens sometimes. But I've been really lucky, and the interesting thing is at 57... It seems like the kids listen to me more now at 57 than they listen to me at like 45. Somehow I'm now even older to the point where, I don't know, it's like maybe a sine wave where I'm at the point now where I'm listenable, and maybe in 5 years I'll be an asshole again, so they won't listen
to
me.
Or maybe they don't want to contradict you because they're afraid you might die.
Well, there's always that possibility.
That's sort of be his last record. Let's just take it easy.
Yeah.
I sort of have a question in the same world.
First question by
Steve.
Hello, Steve.
Which sort of starts from the Eventide thing. Like, I feel like that time in, you know, gear and recording and studios, it was all about like more, 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 make it faster, you know, more tracks. What can we do to get this faster, better? And it turned into digital. And now it seems like that's almost like not cool. And it's like, there's this cool thing to do it all analog or try to.
Well, But so, yeah, I guess some people...
And there's sort of like these two things like fighting each other. And I'm just wondering about your thoughts on that. Like this like coming up, trying to get better and better and progress with technology. Mm. And then it turns into computers. And then computers become limitless.
Right.
And it kind of ties into what you were saying about having limitations.
Right.
Or not.
Right. No, no, it's great. I mean, the great thing about analog was even at 48 tracks, you know, two 24-track machines synced up, I mean, you still, you know, had somewhat limits, you know, and it was pretty great.
It gets
to have
messy
limits
at 48 tracks.
Yeah, and it's hard, man, because that was pre, you know, automation for mixing. So you'd have like, you know, four pair of hands pushing shit around all the time. The other thing we did back then was we'd mix section at a time. Right. You know, you'd mix the verse, you get it right, mix the chorus, edit it together and say, okay, that works. You know what I mean? You'd put a song together like that a lot.
Right.
But no, the thing with the benefit of being an older guy is I learned how to do it with constraints. So now in Pro Tools, I work Pro Tools way faster. You know what I mean? I don't need a million tracks to do shit. But I do get the mixes when I have 105 tracks of just all kinds of room mics on everything.
Like
and
40 vocals.
Yeah, and you just got a fucking deal. I love fucking just muting tracks and just, I don't need that. I don't need that. No, it's not to the point. Not to the point. It's a waste, you know. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, it's interesting. You have to, being an older guy, once again, I've learned how to make really, really fast first decisions that are hopefully good. I think good decisions, you know what I mean? Like first thought, best thought, shit like that.
Do you go with more like it's more about the source and the artist?
I think more about the vibe.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I always feel like it's about the vibe. You know, that's why I'm not a huge like auto-tune grid guy.
Yeah.
Because I feel like that's just
kills all vibe.
It kills the vibe.
Yeah.
And that's why I'm also a big everybody play together vibe.
Right.
Because you don't get a happy accident when the bass player's sitting in the control room playing it to the speakers, like matching the drums like perfectly.
Yeah.
You know, you don't get the cool push and pull. I mean, records definitely are fun when they have elbows and angles and things that maybe aren't perfect. I mean, you know, if someone fucks up totally, I'm not going to just say like, that's cool. You know, but it's good to have a little push and pull.
Yeah, I mean, accidents on records are like some of my favorite parts now.
I always like doing also stuff on records where it's like a kid, 3 or 4, listens in on headphones, will hear something weird.
Right.
Like a panning thing. Like
sure.
I work with that band Twin Peaks. And I knew they would be into me just making shit move around all the time, left to right.
That's cool.
That guy's over there now. That guy, you know, and it was just like, they were like, wait, wasn't that guy? And I was like, yeah, he's over there now. He's fine. You know what I mean?
That's
but
awesome.
They loved it. Yeah. They were really into it. It was fun for them. So I feel like that's once again the fun thing, you know, like not really. And that's a good thing about Pro Tools, which I like, is you can move things around. You know what I mean? You can do things easily that you couldn't do with analog.
Right.
So
you don't have to have an assistant with the pan.
Yeah,
pot.
Dude. Yeah. I used to be that guy. Trust me.
John, I had a question. I have to write about so many newer bands, and it seems like this whole kind of 90s alternative music that you came up with is so many younger bands are sort of going after that sound now. It feels like it's being a resurgence. When you were recording, you know, Sonic Youth, Dinosaur Jr., these bands in the 90s, did you have a sense it was something special was happening?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Like, the grunge thing in the 90s was the best. I was totally pumped.
What was it like sort of being a part? I mean, did it just happen all of a sudden? Like what was it like kind of being in the industry then?
Because I can't assume you were happy with the hair metal thing happening.
Oh, dude. Should I tell you my Kip Winger story?
Yes,
you must.
Please.
Okay. So
finally, 1 million downloads.
I don't know. 1994, 95, I'm working on The Last Temptation of Alice Cooper in Sony Studios.
Also a comic book by Neil Gaiman. Keep going.
There you go. And Alice is, you know, I'm engineering Don Fleming, who I started with, like, in the first Screaming Trees record, who's a wonderful guy, was producing. And long story short, the last day of tracking, who comes to visit us but Kip Winger, who had played, I guess, in earlier variations of Alice's, like, metal band.
Okay.
And Kip, Alice, and Don Fleming are sitting at the console as I'm coiling cables, you know, engineer cleaning up. And Kip is all pissed off because Nirvana's broke, and now Kip is, you know, pretty much dunzo. And Kip is, like, complaining about how, yeah, this fucking band Nirvana, like, what are they? They're like the fucking Knack.
That's, he literally says that. I'm coiling, I'm literally coiling cables. Just if he could have seen the thought bubble in my head, like, douche, you're the knack. Like, these guys are rad. But it was so good that he was really mad at them for, like, putting him out of business. Yeah, it was really good.
That's amazing. The knack. That would, okay.
It's so crazy that Winger had that hit song 17.
Oh, so like, scandalous. The lyrics
what was that, like, 92?
Yeah.
I guess.
It's so scandalous for that.
But isn't the weirder thing about Winger is, isn't the guitarist like some sort of virtuoso?
Red Beach, yeah.
He's
yeah.
like some sort of jazz, like can play anything, like that kind of, like a yeah. Nuno Bettencourt type.
The 80s yeah. was just filled, though, with music and movies that would be so inappropriate.
Yeah.
Now. There's
yeah,
like yeah. so much of it.
It's always been that way.
I mean, yeah,
the late great yeah. Chuck Berry, you know, he wrote a song about it and then did it. You know,
I mean, there's a video all, of it.
Did yeah. what, Steven?
Took a young girl off state lines and went to prison for it.
I didn't think
you don't
could
know
get
a lot about these people
for taking people across state lines.
It's called a man act, and if you had seen Smoking the Bandit, you'd be aware. Correct?
There you go. Well done. Well played, sir.
And so when you heard, Nevermind and that kind of stuff, were you instantly?
I was pumped. Yeah. But also, once again, I'm always like 10 years older than the crew. You know what I mean? Because I was born in 59. So even with Jay, I'm like 10 years older than them, and with Lanigan, I was always like just older. So it wasn't like I was part of the scene. But I got to be involved in the scene and kind of help make records, like with Tad and, you know, stuff like that. It was really fun. I spent a lot of time in Seattle, and that was a blast. I had so much fun.
That's
like making records there. It was really neat.
I saw Tad open for Soundgarden, the Super Unknown Tour.
Amazing.
They slayed.
Yeah.
Did yeah, like, awesome. You know, you were involved in it. And I guess you said you weren't surprised. You knew it was special.
I knew it was so good.
Did you get the impression that the guys in the bands, they really knew something was happening?
They were just doing their
no
thing.
Clue.
Yeah, they were just fucking...
just doing it.
I remember working on a Tad record when two of the guys were sitting on the couch and Super Unknown was being recorded in the main room at Bad Animals. And Randy Johnson, the really tall pitcher from the Mariners, went to visit them. And he was a huge Tad fan. And he came into the studio to say hello to them. And I turned around, and this really huge, thin guy had to duck under the door jamb to come in and say hello. And two of the guys were smoking hash, watching TV, and they went, "Hey." And I was like, "Hey." Like, I was, like, totally psyched, and they were just like, "Hey." And they, like, could give a fuck. And he left, and I was like, "That was fucking Randy Johnson, goddammit." And they were like, "Whatever."
No cares.
Yeah, they didn't fucking care. They were just doing their thing.
He can throw a ball 102 miles an hour, man.
I was just like,
I don't even know sports. I know that guy. Yeah. I remember in, like, Dinosaur Jr. has gone on record talking about how, like, they broke up before Nirvana, like, hit. And
well, Lou basically got left. Jettisoned.
I saw Dinosaur Jr. right after Lou left, where they're like, "Who can play?" And they got the bass player.
Yeah, Mike Johnson, who was actually pretty awesome guy. He was a Seattle guy, actually.
Yeah, I mean, that was a great tour I saw. It was like 92 or something. But it was they talk about like, well, like did you ever think like Nirvana would be the one that faded away, but Dinosaur Jr. is still the band cranking out like amazing hit, like not amazing hits, but amazing records, you know?
I thought Nirvana, I mean, we were working on Without a Sound the day that they found Kurt's body. Mm. So we were working on a record that fucking day.
Jeez.
Like in, I think it was Baby Monster on 14th Street in Manhattan. And it was just like the whole day we just sat in the lounge watching MTV. We were just like, but to answer your question, I thought they would just make a shitload of records. You know what I mean? They just seemed like they were just, you know, I mean, he seemed like so prolific and just so great as an artist. You know what I mean? I wouldn't say I thought he would have a Neil Young scope of a career, but I was shocked. I never would have thought, you know, he would have, you know,
somebody who like, we talk about that 90s sound, like he like typified that because he touted those influences like Dinosaur Jr. and Pixies and all that, like on his sleeve more than anybody, I think.
Who, Kurt?
Yeah.
I mean, I feel like
that's how I learned what Mud Honey was.
Yeah. I feel like on a certain level, like Smells Like Teen Spirit has a bit of Boston in it. You know what I mean? I feel like there's some major rock chords there that are even kind of Mersh, and you know what I mean? But it delivered in a way that is so angsty
and heartfelt and, you know, almost the grunge version of like the punk or something. You know what I mean? It was
Butch Vig said it's a pop record. He said that's what I heard was pop, you know.
Yeah, right. I always found that with Grohl too, with the drums on those records, that he definitely writes drum riffs, you know, like where it's totally matching the vocals and stuff like that.
Right.
But there are times in those records I'm listening to a groove and I'm like, that is a straight 70s rock group.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That is just like a big
but delivered in a really
a
unique way.
But
yeah,
since
to like
he was
Seattle.
A punk or hardcore mm-hmm. guy or something, maybe he just gave it that little extra life for sure.
Yeah. I mean, John, can you listen to music like just for fun, or like when you're listening to music, are you like, I would mic this differently?
No,
or like,
I never do that.
Really? Mm-hmm.
If I was that guy, I'd hate music. No, seriously. I totally, when I'm not working, I quite frankly, when we finish the Holy Sons record, I mean, that CD goes in the car and it still comes up. We listen to it still a bunch. My daughter knows all the lyrics. My wife loves it. We listen. I never think about the production. I just listen to the record and I just love it. You know what I mean? I sing along. I just crank it. I love the vibe. But other records, like whatever band I'm listening to at a moment, it's not even like I don't think about it at all until someone says, you know, would you make our next record? Then I'm like, okay, let me think about what I would do.
So has there ever been a record that, like, can you separate, like, the production from the song? Like, hear a song and be like, oh, wow, what they did there sounds cool as opposed to what the song sounds like.
Yeah, but those are not necessarily, my favorite records are definitely not great productions and not great songs. You know what I mean? Like, I like, it's songs, you know what mm-hmm. I mean? Like, one of my favorite records of all time, certainly in the 90s, is B-1000, the Guided by Voices song, mm-hmm. which is the ultimate lo-fi record ever. And I just fucking love it, you know? I just did a playlist for a bar that's opening up in our neighborhood called Lo-Fi, and they asked me to do a lo-fi playlist, and I put a bunch of Guided by Voices on it.
Do you know why it's called B-1000?
No.
Check here. This is my favorite trivia, because I love Guided by Voices, and he said it in a show. It's when you hold your tongue and say Pete Townsend.
Pete Townsend. Motherfucker.
Yeah.
I like it.
Wow. So,
yeah. Do you dissect records, though? Like, if you get something, do you ever listen to things as a reference and dissect it? Like, hey, I want you to mix our record, and we kind of want it to sound like this vibe.
You know, I try not to do that because I feel like that's not what I do. And I feel like if someone wants me to work on a record, I'd rather do what I do, and I'll take direction. But like, I mean, even like with a lot of bands who approach me, who've had like a couple of records out, Motion City Soundtrack's a perfect example. I purposely didn't go back, and I knew who they were. My kid was really into them, like, you know, when she was like 20 or something. I purposely didn't go back and listen to their records because I didn't want to get locked into something that I wouldn't do. I wanted to really do something different. You know what I mean? So I almost feel like unless I have to, I'd rather just, you know, hear the songs and just go from there and just, you know, just give it a fresh approach.
How are your ears doing?
What? My ears are fine. You know, the thing is, like, I don't go to a ton of shows. When I do, I wear earplugs. I don't monitor particularly loud. I don't listen to big speakers. I mix low because I feel like that's the best reference. And, I feel like I've taken care of them forever. I've been wearing earplugs for, you know, 25 years, like literally.
You beat the movement.
Well, you know, I had those fucking artist earplugs
forever.
Like, you know, in 1991, I went to an audiologist and,
cool.
You know, what I don't do now is I don't get my hearing checked anymore because fuck that bullshit. You know, I bring my record to the mastering engineer, Greg Calbee, and like, I tell you, I've been mixing at Water Music and I bring my record to him and like, he still like at times masters songs flat, which to me is like, you know, fuck it. I don't want to go to a doctor. I can hear okay. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like, I don't worry about that shit. I definitely don't psych myself out. Right. But I definitely do take care. And I think the monitoring low is really good. And then, you know, when guys want to crank it, I just, like, stand in the back of the room.
All right. Where's your, like, I know a lot of engineers and stuff, they love listening on a very particular sound system, the one that they trust, the one that they've known for a long time.
You mean in studio or at home?
Either. I know a lot of guys who will be in the middle of a studio and burn it on CD and pop it out to their car.
Yeah. I used to do
that. That sense. Where's like the most consistent place for you to listen to a mix where you can hear that variation the most?
Well, here's what I do now, which I've been doing for like 10 years, which works great for me. Every studio I go to, I put a CD in Where You Been, the Dinosaur Jr. record, and I listen to that song, Get Me, Okay. Like five times in a row. Huh. Like first thing while I'm patching everything and setting everything up. That song I know sonically great top to bottom. And we did it with your record. Mm-hmm. I just put it in first thing. And I listen right at the sweet spot in the console. So I understand how everything sounds at the console. Sorry. But I also know the inadequacies of that song. You know what I mean? I'm not saying that song is perfect.
Right.
You know what I mean? I just know.
You know it inside out.
I know it where it's at. And then I just go at the sweet spot. I used to do the car thing, and I just find the car thing, and then, you know, earbuds and on this computer. It's a waste of time.
Yeah.
It really is. Because if you really know where you're sitting, where you're doing it, you're good. And I don't care. I mean, if guys want to take it out to the car, that's fine. You know, I don't say, no, you can't listen. But at a certain point, like I said, I've been so locked in at Water Music in Hoboken that the fact that Calbee masters a lot of my shit just flat is great. And it's like bringing your term paper to the professor. You know, every time still, after all this time working with him at 91, when I bring him the record or I send him the record and I get the phone call from him, I'm like, fuck. And he's like, no, it sounds great. If I did like this song flat, this one I added like a dB of 10K, and I was like, whew, all right. Nailed another one. Another doctorate for Johnny.
You know who this Greg Calbee guy is?
I don't.
I don't know.
Go ahead, tell him.
Well, he's amazing. Just like, you know, in the running for like the most legendary master in the world. And he, he's done like a list of records that, you know, are probably thought of. And this would be where my point. Music is so highly psychological. You know, you can technically analyze it, but really the way it affects you emotionally is a pretty Taoist plane. You know, it's this kind of relative. You know, you can probably talk all day about whatever, you know, API board is run through, but like, we were sitting down with Greg Calbee, and he's done Dylan, John Lennon, Tom Petty, all
the
stuff.
Damn the Torpedoes.
Yeah, everything.
Unforgettable Fire.
And these things become psychological watermarks for people entering into music, right? Mm-hmm. They're like, oh, that's what a record sounds like. Not realizing that they're made by other flawed human beings that are just kind of approximating an image of what they think rock music is or whatever. Sure. So you enter into this kind of beautiful confluence of factors that don't necessarily have to be that way, but they happened that way, and we all take it as like law. You know what I mean? So we're sitting down with Greg Calbee, and I just thought, I should probably ask him a question. I have like 5 minutes to ask him a question. And the only thing I could think of was basically kind of what you guys just asked. John's like, when you go home and you're ready to relax and you pour yourself a big glass of whiskey and you put on a record, you know, what are you actually going to want to listen to sonically? What's going to make you happy, being that this is the guy who's kind of, he's the filter that all this music has come through. At the end of the day, what does he want to hear? And where do his values kind of focus, you know, their aesthetic pleasure? And he was like, he basically said what John is saying, like he doesn't have any interest in production, actually. It was like this hilarious thing. You know, it's his job to make things sound good, but when you get home and you put something on, your psychological impression of what you're hearing in ways is beyond reason. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so he said, his answer was like, I just listen to songs, and, you know, if the songs are awesome, that's my favorite record.
Were expecting some humdinger, like a real...
I actually didn't know why I was even asking it, but I wanted to. I like to ask people questions a lot, and I like to try to put them in a position that gives me some practical like takeaway, you know. And I wanted to just kind of force them into some position that, if even if it was awkward, I would learn something. And it's funny because I've told this story a few times, so obviously I picked up something, and he like cited some Peter Gabriel record, which I'm not an expert on him, but he was saying like, it's a terrible sounding record, but it's like my favorite record. So it just goes to show you.
Must be Security.
I can't remember which one it was, But Peter Gabriel fans at home are like shaking their fists.
All the diehard Peter Gabriel fans. That's why I'm sitting. I'm like, which one sounds?
But they're all called Peter Gabriel, so it's hard to tell which one.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah, it's like, is one with the melting fingers and the melting.
Yeah, the first three are all called Peter Gabriel. Yeah. Yeah. Total mind fuck.
It's also just totally fucking relative,
lazy prick.
You know? Yeah, because it's like whatever you really decide, and even if you're wrong, just straight up wrong, and you enter the industry, and you may become the guy that invents the Eventide harmonizer. You may become the guy who invents a new form of dance music, because that shit sounds completely wrong in so many ways. Like the snares are like super sped up in some crazy jungle way. The bass drum were actually sampled cardboard boxes. Like, that's wrong, but it's totally right to somebody. Mm-hmm. Not to like do an old like cliche, like it just doesn't fucking matter or anything, but that is really interesting that a lot of music that you're hearing when you hit play, a lot of it is operating outside of your hearing range. So you're getting all these vibrations that aren't necessarily things that you can coherently discern. So there is magic involved in listening to music. And if a kid just like sticks a mic on a fucking refrigerator hum, weird things happen. And someone like John might be like, that's my favorite new record. You don't know. You don't know.
I listen to that and talk radio. I can't decide what I like more.
Same difference.
Yeah.
I love talk radio. I was wondering, I saw that you were saying one of the issues with the technology and like you were saying, the ease of Pro Tools and the patching and the things you can do have maybe, as an ancillary, forced bands to not focus on arrangement as much.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, recently I was having a bit of like a 70s day at my house, and I was listening to a Steely Dan record. And I'm not like the biggest Dan fan in the world, but I'm like listening to it really part by part. I'm listening to bass, I'm listening to drum parts, and I'm like, Jesus Christ, like, this is recorded live. I don't even know if I know anyone
who
can play this live. The one with the hits on it.
Is it Asia?
The hits? No.
They all have hits, man.
Asia's the one, but Asia's the one where they have
the one with the reeling in the ears on it.
Okay, so that's like the first one.
Yeah, okay.
So
I'm listening to the actual parts, and I'm like having a hard time in my head thinking of a person I know who could actually execute this part live.
Yeah.
And do you really see that, like, a loss of craftsmanship and musicianship over the years?
I don't necessarily think that. I think... I'll give you a perfect example. I'm in the middle of a record with this girl, Jessica Lee Mayfield, who's on ATO. And my band, which was wonderful, which was Steve Shelley from Sonic Youth on drums, Emil on bass, and my buddy Cam, who was in the Streets of Laredo on guitar, and her playing guitar. And so I put together my like little wrecking crew, you know, and these guys played the shit out of this record. And it was wonderful, and it was inspiring, and it was fun. They came up with great ideas. And I feel like that can still happen. You know what I mean? And the record has a vibe because of that.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it's not perfect like the Steely Dan record, but the record has a life that it wouldn't have had if her buddies from Nashville come up and play.
Gotcha.
So there are still people out there who can do what they do. I mean, Emil's a perfect example of his chops on every instrument I've seen him play are so amazing. Like, as a bass player, he's, to me, is so much fun because he can go off full on like crazy Paul McCartney riffing the whole time, or he can hold it down, or he can do both. And it's really a pleasure watching him musically play around the vocal, which is such a key element to recording, to being good at arranging yourself.
And something a lot of bass players don't know.
Well, and drummers. God damn. Drummers, like, you know, a drummer who can actually listen to the vocal and play a fill around the vocal as opposed to over the vocal is wonderful, and know when to push and pull and stuff like that.
Unicorns.
Huh?
We're unicorns. I'm putting myself in this.
Dude, no, good for you.
There's a giant horn coming out of Benny's head.
But you know what I mean? But you know what I mean? It's really
there you go. A banana corn.
But the thing is, so I think guys are still out there.
Yeah.
But you're right, and I've also worked on records where, you know, you're mixing and they're still arranging, and that would never happen if I was producing, but as an engineer, you know, you got to go with the flow sometimes.
Yeah.
But no, as a producer, I'm a big fan of the
rehearsals. You know, I sit with the artist, we do the arrangements, then we rehearse and we get the stuff together, and not rehearse to the point where it's like everybody's yawning and they know the songs, but rehearsing to the point that everybody has their thing together, and then let's have fun in the studio.
Right.
I think it's super important to still do that, and I'm pretty lucky, once again, as an older guy, to know that chain of events, you know, and really feel like that's important. And, you know, I've done stuff like a whole steady record where we did a bunch of songs like that, and then we left one song that they didn't know that we learned in the studio, and we just did it in the studio, and that was fun. Right. But I wouldn't do a whole record like
that.
I wouldn't bet, like bank on a record being coming out great by doing that every song. That would scare the shit out of me.
I was curious about that because whenever movers come, I'm always like, I always ask them, like, do you ever come to people's houses and just nothing is packed? And they're like, yes. Like, yeah. People, we come in and, like, literally.
What do they do?
They were basically like, we'll just leave, or we'll, like, just wait around and we'll charge them more. But, yeah, I was curious. Like, it must be the same thing as, like,
it's crazy.
Making a record. If you come to the studio, it's like, yeah, we sort of have these ideas. It's like, what?
I didn't know that existed until Gaslight signed to a major label, and I started talking to some A&R guys and poking their heads about other bands, and particularly big ones. I'm not going to say which bands they were, but there was one band in particular we were scheduled to be released 3 months after them. And this was the whole marketing plan, too, is
right.
That their record comes out, then there needs to be this wait and this and that. We finished our record, and they were still on, like, song 3, producer 4, studio 7, never had songs start with. And even though someone else is paying for it, I don't know if it's because I'm from Jersey, I have a different sensibility. I'm like, why the fuck?
You and your Jersey
aren't
attitude.
You just sitting in your fucking garage somewhere writing songs and not spending $1 million and flying all over and doing this
but
shit?
But for perspective, is it like a U2 or REM style band, or is it a band that's putting out their second record?
It was a band who had hits and we're like looking for more.
So, but
that
not,
level,
not on a U2 level, not that big, right?
Close at one point, at a height.
Yeah, because I mean, I know guys like that. Once you've gotten to that realm,
right?
You know,
you don't know how to step
back. Yeah, all bets are off. I mean, you know, so the guitar player for whatever band goes to Jamaica with his Rickenbacker and a Vox amp and spends a week trying to get a guitar sound and can't do it and they leave.
Right.
You know what I mean? That's fucking ludicrous.
On the label's dime.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Or on their, you know, they signed a, you know, a $50 million 3-record deal, you know. So,
and then give it away for free on iTunes.
Well, whatever. But the point is, like, you know, that shit still happens when you're on that level. But certainly, you know, at the working, you know, I want to say indie rock, well, whatever, the working reality of today is, you know, I got my bands, like, you know, pretty much knowing what they're doing. I mean, I want to go in, come in on budget. You know what I mean? I'm not doing an emo record, a Holy Sons record, and coming in like $50,000 over budget. That's fucking ridiculous. Right. You know, there's no reason for that.
Sure.
Yeah, people forget you got the art, but, you know, there's business.
So, yeah, you know, listen, I always joke with people like my neighbors who think like, oh, your music, you know, great lifestyle, blah, blah, blah. You know, like, oh, you the party life and all that shit. I'm like, dude, I'm like a product manager in a way.
Yeah.
You know, because the other hat is I get a budget of whatever amount of money and I got to bring this product in for that amount of money. I've got responsibilities. I'm not like, you know, doing lines off of emails like butt, you know, in the control room.
When do you do that, though? When do the lines off the butt happen?
The end of record party.
Fair enough. Fair enough.
There's one question I got to get in before it stops because I feel like you've recorded so many classically awesome guitar players who use classically awesome sounds. And even currently, even with like Kurt Vile and stuff like that, what in your estimation is the perfect or the coolest, not just perfect, guitar to pedal to amp scenario? Is there like just one golden goose?
No, I can't, because you know Thurston and Lee are different from Kurt and Jay. You know, I honestly feel just like depends. I just put the mics really close to the amp. And though I'm lucky with those guys. Those guys all have their signature tone. I mean, Jay is, you know, the first record I worked on with him, Where You Been, he put this fucking blanket up on the control room window so I couldn't see out into the studio and had a million pedals. And I would just sit there and he would go clunk, 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 clunk. And then he would go, okay, and he hit the pedal, brr, and then I would record, you know. It was like he just wanted to be in his own space and didn't want, you know. So I would put my mics just right up on the amp and make sure they sound good. Not even much EQ. I've been really lucky. I mean, honestly, it's like those guys get great tones, and I'm lucky enough not, you know, to be smart enough to capture that shit. Yeah. You know, I can't, like, I'm no rainmaker when it comes to that shit. You know what I mean? Those guys are fucking great.
So in that logic is part of the greatness in doing something that you do, knowing when to let a talented person just go nuts.
Yeah, I mean, listen, I might walk out and tweak an amp now and then. Right. I mean, certainly with the younger kids, I will do a lot of tweaking and stuff like that. But those guys are four examples of guys who don't need me to fucking tweak their shit.
You're about to set off an eBay frenzy with that one.
Yeah, I could make shit up. Yeah. You know?
This pedal's now $3,000.
A tip one like the
It's the BC Rich Bitch and for a Roland JC-120.
It's a crate.
You gotta get that metal zone in there.
Yeah, get the metal zone. There you go.
A couple of DOD pedals.
Yeah. Perfect. I wish I made my own pedal. I could just say it's the John and Yellow Special Flaccid Overdrive.
Actually, this is kind of a nerdy question. Has anyone ever asked you to do like signature plug-in presets?
I do some for my brother's company, Eventide.
You do?
Yeah, do a couple. There's a couple on the H9 that are like my things. Yeah.
Nice. Sorry. Yeah. I went to
fucking mixed magazines.
All right, so here's a plug. So Eventide's got this new plug-in that's really cool, Fission, that separates the attack to the decay and to the tone and all that, and you can actually rework shit. And I've got me and my buddy Stuart, we have a podcast called Gear Club. I'll plug that too.
Nice.
Which is very new. It's only six in, and it's just
great.
You know, it's like the Car Talk of audio.
I can listen to it all day.
Yeah.
I just keep thinking right now that so one of our other hosts, Brad, who's the producer who we worked with over at Rubber Tracks forever, and one of our old friends who's in the Goops and all that. The fact that he is not here right now, I just keep thinking of how bad he is going to be flipping out.
Is he?
Oh, my God. He would have so many questions. He mixes all our stuff and does everything.
Oh, cool.
He's just the man.
I can come back whenever you guys want. This is fun.
Yeah, that'd be amazing.
I'm now like the queen of podcasts. I feel like between my podcast and this, you know.
You can come back all the time.
Yeah, no, I love this shit.
You could guest host.
You know, please. I never thought about doing this at all until my bro told me and my buddy Stuart, hey, you guys should do a podcast. We were like, fuck it, we're too busy. And then we just did, like, last June, we did, like, an hour of just bullshitting with each other, just having fun, doing what we would normally talk about at a restaurant or, you know, at a bar. And it turns out it's, like, a good rapport. You know, we're, like, buddies for 30 years, and we both make music. So, but no, but anyway, yeah, I would, you know, it's, to me, this is fun now. I'm really enjoying it.
All right.
Yeah.
Thank you to John and Yellow for coming on the podcast.
Yeah,
please check out John's podcast, Gear Club. And if you want to record a record with John, you should email him.
And you should do it at Pulse Music.
Yeah, you can make the record here.
Steven would be happy to assist, right? Do you assist still?
Absolutely.
Okay, there you go.
So do a record. Steven, John, and Yellow can record your band here. I don't know how much it would cost or what their availability is.
But you could sound as good as we sound right
now.
Yeah,
you could sound this good. So think about it. You could also record it here without John.
And save some money.
And probably save a lot of money.
And you know what? It might even sound better. Steven's amazing. I think you could just use Steven.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, you could. I mean, it just kind of depends what you're going for. If you have any money left over after that, you can Venmo it to us to help us support our server costs. Our Venmo name is at OffTrack, OFFTRACK, and the account is linked to Brad's name. I'm not sure why he won't explain it to me. Every time I bring it up, he tries to change the subject.
It's okay. There's no money there.
Yeah. So, yeah, we haven't gotten any money yet, which is so weird. It's weird. Brad said I actually owe him money and made me pay
him. He sent you a Venmo request.
Yeah. So I paid it. He said we had a lot of, maintenance fees. So
I've got some maintenance fees, man.
Yeah. Yeah, so please send me money so I can pay back Brad. You can also like us on iTunes, subscribe, tell your friends about us, tweet at us, let us know you're listening. And yeah, thank you so much to John. Thanks to Pulse Music. And we'll be back with another podcast next week. Yeah!
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.